Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So, you seem to have survived the first day of retreat. I think you're all still here, in one piece. Or at least externally. I don't know what's going on inside, but... The story that is described in the little chanting of invitation to offer a Dhamma talk, for some of you who still don't know this, is a... when the Buddha, according to the history of the Buddha's life, when the Buddha, after the Buddha was enlightened, he realized that what he had discovered was so profound and so extraordinary that he felt most humans were just obsessed with their own life and their own sensory desires and just survival and so on. He didn't think anybody would be even either interested or, if interested, might never understand the depth of his realization. So he was just about to give up on mankind when Brahma Sahampati, the god, saw this, and immediately he saw this and went to see the Buddha and begged him to teach the Dhamma in case there were people with little dust in their eyes who could actually understand. And this is exactly the meaning of this little chant. You have this in your book. You can check the translation. The sweet story. Thanks to God Brahma Sahampati, we have the teaching of the Buddha, at least the last Buddha, here with us, still available, still very... relevant to our life, and also teaching that we can understand, we can realize and apply in our everyday life. Now the teaching is indeed profound and extensive. It's good to know that the refuge in the Buddha, the refuge in the awakened mind, is in the here and now, in terms of practice, in terms of realization. It is happening here and now. We don't need to know everything. We don't need to have read all the books, understood all the suttas, to be present and to develop a clarity of insight, a clarity of knowing that enables us to free ourselves from the veils of delusion. And they are like veils. They're really like layers upon layers of perceptions and ways of looking at life, the world, ourselves, people, which is very much rooted in suffering. So the roots is suffering, and so the result naturally will be suffering. Thanks to the teaching, we can actually realize that. We can see that this suffering is not there forever. There is a way out, there is an exit out of suffering, a way of coming to the end of this experience of suffering. Now, one day sitting on your cushion on retreat, I don't think you need a lot of explanations to make you understand suffering, do you? that cuts down through a lot of books reading and mind-boggling kind of commentaries on teaching and nirvana and so on. Just sitting for an hour with oneself is enough if you're really truly aware, is enough to give you a taste of the predicament we are part of. We begin the practice by establishing this foundation of mindfulness. And this is, you could say, the beginning of practice, the middle, the end, right to the end of our path, right to the end of liberation from all suffering. This foundation is our reference point. It's our guide, not only our guide, but also the quality, that aspect of the mind which can lead you to the end of delusion. Now, mindfulness doesn't come about on its own. It has it needs certain condition to become aware. And most of us we've experienced that awareness often through it is unfortunate that most human beings wake up through the experience of suffering. So see, this experience of suffering is not a waste of time if it wakes us up. This is why in many of the teaching, Buddhist teachings, it is often pointed out that this human life is very precious. Very, very precious, because from the perspective of the teaching, the realization that the Buddha handed down, it's very, very rare to have this opportunity to be human and to see the unsatisfactoriness of both pain and pleasure. In other realms of the heavenly beings, we are told that a heavenly being can spend eons of time just enjoying themselves, not really realizing the urgency of liberation. So we can get stuck into a heavenly realm, feel really good. Even in our meditation we can do that. And just get stuck in there, never get liberated, never activate wisdom. Mindfulness, the conditions that awaken this quality of mindfulness, in my experience, certainly was suffering. Wasn't an intense suffering particularly. It was just probably the end of a long road, not seeing that there was the end of something and the beginning of another. But it was just this desire to not be trapped in the same old ruts, with an understanding that desire, you know, the energy of desire could never be satisfied. I don't know if you've had this experience. It's almost like an... And I remember it was Munch, the famous painter. Munch. There's a famous painting of his. I don't know if any of you know it. But it's a picture of this... It's a quite an extraordinary face and sort of... And it really, to me, it was a description of this kind of cry inside all of us, this kind of it's called a scream. Scream. So screaming for understanding. And it is interesting when suffering suddenly wakes us up. Now we can see this, we may have this experience even long before we meet the Buddhist teaching. We don't need to be a Buddhist to know that. It can happen any time in our life. And the understanding is when suddenly suffering is seen as just it's like the palm of your hand, the back and the palm, you can see that suffering and joy are very close together. And suffering is one aspect of reality, and then joy is the when we have understood suffering, we're liberated from suffering, then there's joy. The mind, the release of suffering, the mind free from suffering. even not necessarily totally liberated from suffering, but just even momentarily. It also, mindfulness also is very much dependent on energy. Without energy, how can we stay awake? You notice when you're tired, when you are, your energy is low, all you want to do is fall asleep. So physically, we can even understand that just on a physical level, if you have little energy, you just not much, you can't do very much. You know? Not to mention staying awake. So energy is also an aspect of practice which is very essential. It's called virya. It's the one aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, virya, sometimes translated as effort. But it's also a force in us that is generated through other conditions too. So for example, as we take on board discipline of restraint, that restraint itself generates energy. You might not be aware of it, but as we simplify our capacity to simplify, let's say, the choices that we have in life, the choices, like you've taken the eight precepts, you have taken, you intend to refrain from doing a number of things that normally you engage with, like just using your computer. So effort, energy. Now, how is that raised? How do we raise energy in ourselves? A lot of our energy is dissipated in so many things, not to mention thinking constantly without even knowing what we are thinking, worrying, planning, remembering, and then dissipated through eating at any time of day and night, or drinking, or trying to get something out there, desires of any sorts. A lot of our energy gets dissipated, scattered. And we wonder sometimes why we feel sick, why we can't, we can't go through the day. We just don't have the skill of bringing about energy into our mind and body. So restraint is a way of doing that. Even though it's uncomfortable, even though it's not particularly pleasant to have to give up dancing, singing, a meal in the evening, talking, having a chat around a nice coffee or a nice meal in the evening, even though it's not pleasant, there is a quality of, there's a quality, a tone that comes about when we don't act on those familiar avenues, those familiar ways of satisfying oneself. So, the precept, just by taking the precepts, you have already raised energy. The intention itself is a kind of focusing, that kind of, it's quite extraordinary. I remember when I was a novice, a chittist, even thinking about fasting the next day, even though I find it difficult, I didn't like the idea of fasting for 2 days, but sometimes I would just do it because many people were doing it too. I was not alone, so he didn't want to be the last one lagging behind, perhaps, but there were lots of different reasons. Just experimenting, or sometimes just for fun. When you're quite young, you're excitable, you like things interesting. I mean, just even ascetic practices can become just you know, another thing to do. So fasting, just even the thought of fasting the next day, I remember, I had lots of energy suddenly. And I was always surprised. Why do I have all this energy suddenly, just knowing that the next day I'm not going to eat? It was just noticeable. And I was kind of wondering, why did that happen? You know, I have my own explanations. It was suddenly my mind could not go into fantasizing about food, you know, when you don't eat for a whole day. There's a lot of, you know, you don't worry about the bills, you don't worry about, you know, the insurance, but you start worrying about the next meal, what you're going to have. Or even not worry, just enjoy the possibility of something nice. You just have a kind of fantasy about what you're going to eat. I didn't think I had, of course, all this. I thought I was superior to that. You know, that I was not the kind of person that would just kind of fantasize, indulge in those low sort of things. But I noticed when I was not going to eat the next day, my mind was very focused, you know, and I thought, what's that? And it was, suddenly, it just didn't have any doorways to fantasize about anything. So it's quite extraordinary. If you take that principle in other areas, then you might discover a lot about yourself. And this is a way of raising energy, you know. And we need that to practice. We need a lot of energy, in fact. That's why on the spiritual path, on the path of really liberation, you know, there is a lot of discipline to bring about this effort. One way is to become a monk or a nun. That's just to bring a lot of effort. You simplify your life. You know, cut down a lot of avenues. Not that I'm encouraging all of you to become monks and nuns, but this is just a mean. Being a monk or a nun is just a mean to an end, rather than an end in itself. So, effort. How much do we spend time talking in our life? How much do we spend time eating? How much we spend time fantasizing about tomorrow, about people, about the past, about me? Thinking, endlessly thinking about this and that. And then once we spend a long time on doing that, then the flip side of that is that we get tired and we just want to sleep. So we use all sorts of things to sleep. We use drink, we use drugs, we use media, we use all sorts of different things that shuts consciousness, shut down the mind. You know, we can go just into a fantasy realm too. That's a way of getting out of reality. And there's a lot of waste there, you know, a lot of dissipation. Just to use the example of food, I have always witnessed in myself that when I eat a meal, for example, I need a rest afterwards. When I eat little or don't eat much, I'm never tired. I don't even think of resting, or it just doesn't come up in the mind. It doesn't come up. You know, so we are very much conditioned by simple physical things. You know, we think, oh, I need to rest, or I need this, I need that. Often not knowing that these thoughts come up in response to bodily sensations. You know, a simple sensation can take you a very long way and can complicate life endlessly. Just one sensation that you haven't been aware of, or maybe frightened of. You know. So, with energy, with mindfulness, you know, we can begin to do the work. you know, the work of meditation. And we can see meditation as, in many ways, you know, there are a lot of misperceptions about meditation. You know, we see meditation as a way of becoming more powerful, as a way of, you know, developing psychic powers, so we can go through walls, read people's mind, become happy forever, healthy forever. We can, you know, meditation is a very broad word, but in the Buddhist context, in Buddhist meditation, it's it's a way of looking at the mind so that you penetrate that delusion and have what we call, what is usually called as liberating insight. You know, but for that you need energy, you need effort, you need mindfulness, and the ability to sustain this attention over a long period of time. If we look and then we go to something else and look again, go to something else and look again and go to something else, we are never really going to understand because we keep being distracted, you know. And that's what we do in meditation. No, that's what, we don't do that, but this is what happens when we look at the mind, whether we are sitting or walking, or you begin to notice how distracted consciousness, the realm of consciousness, is a very distracted experience, constantly moving from one thing to another. It's called the monkey's mind. You know, spend the whole day just, you know, jumping from one thing to another, and then we feel restless and we wonder, why do I feel restless? I wonder, what's going on? You feel restless because you identify with everything that's happening in consciousness, you know. That's why you feel restless. So that you know, we're trying to build up, cultivate and build up this foundation of mindfulness, which is like your resting place, the place in which you can turn to when the boat is rocking, you know, when the storms come. And samsara, the realm of birth and death, which is also depicts the realm of our human realm, the realm of constant movement, constant realm of desire, being reborn, born and reborn, dying and reborn, and so on, is often depicted as an ocean in waves, constantly agitating. You know. But deep in the ocean, there's not much movement going on, and so we tend to stay on the surface of things. We tend to stay with the waves, constantly identifying with each little wave. One thing curling up, coming in, whoops, that's really nice. And another one coming along, oh, I like that one. Oh, I don't like that one. One big wave, oh, I like to surf on that one. That would be really fun. Well, eventually this is what we have to do. I like always the idea of surfing the waves of samsara rather than constantly going through the experience of crushing and not even seeing the waves, not even enjoying the waves. So, in meditation, we can spend a lot of time creating ourselves as somebody meditating here, going somewhere, doing something, becoming. And this is part of, you could say, the program of ignorance, is that we keep constantly identifying with what is called the self or I. You know, everything that we go through has the potential to become very personal if we grasp at it, if we hold on to it. And this is really what we are made of, in a way. The way we exist is that as a mass of grasping. We grasp long enough to be who we are right now. This is a result of our grasping, what we are now at this very moment. So don't complain. But you played your part in being who you are right now, even though it mostly happened unconsciously, it happened by itself. But we tend to think that we are very responsible. We feel very responsible for who we are. And you could say, yes, at some level we participate in the way we create ourselves. But when you look closely, then you realize how much this creation is just happening on its own. It doesn't have much. It doesn't have a kind of a center. It's just constantly coming up. You've noticed, even when you don't want to be angry, you become angry, despite yourself. Even however much you don't want to become bored, you do become bored. And no matter however much you don't want to be hungry and think about the meal tomorrow, you still think about them, even when you don't want to think about them. So the mind is not there's not a center there that you can control, it's just an ongoing flow of things. I had an experience once when I had this, in a way, it was like an insight, you could say, about the selflessness of my anger. It was a small insight, it wasn't a great sort of thing, but it was noticeable. I remember when I was a chittast, I was a novice, and I was quite angry with something. I was quite angry with somebody, maybe, or I'd become a. I was left with a lot of anger about somebody who had irritated me. And this anger felt quite natural for me. I felt quite at ease being angry and righteous about, yeah, she shouldn't have done this. Whoa, feeling very right about it. And then later on, and I planned to do something about that. I had a whole scheme about how I was going to deal with my anger, with a person, with myself. There was a whole project there. And then a few hours later, I tried to recall the anger, and I couldn't. It was so frustrating. I actually couldn't. I tried to get angry with the person again, and it had gone. And I was left with nothing to chew on. Nothing to have a grudge against. It was so disappointing. It was something really, so you can see how little bent we are on liberation. Most of our programming is just attached to some kind of excitable thing that can... we can get our teeth into and get heated up about. So beside mindfulness which, by the way, I didn't mention that, but in the traditional text, we have a very, Buddha describes very clearly what he calls the four foundations of mindfulness. So mindfulness, he gives us a clear indication of what to look at. We don't look at any old thing. We don't go around the world trying to be mindful of everything. Because that would be really a tall order, wouldn't it? But he did say, this is what will be useful for you. If you look at your body, if you're mindful of your body in the four postures, sitting, lying down, walking, standing, if you can look at your feelings, vedana, you can be aware of your feelings, sensations. You can be aware of the quality of your mind. You can see, you can notice if the mind is tight or concentrated, radiant, expanded, focused or unfocused. This is something you can observe. And you can observe. And then going to the last one, the fourth, is the content of your mind. So the Buddha gives us a whole list of things that we can look at. The Four Noble Truths, the Six Sense Bases. There's a whole list of things that can help us to understand more deeply the nature of the mind. So it's not like we've left with just this kind of abstract thing of mindfulness. You know, there's a very concrete practice of staying mindfulness of the body. This is what you've been doing today, sitting, standing, walking, noticing the body, noticing its sensations, noticing thoughts, noticing cold, hot, noticing contact, the contact of the body, noticing hearing, sound, the six sense bases, nose, tongue, ears, body, mind, and tongue, taste. These are, it's like a very rich field of investigation, as you can see. Now that can seem a bit sort of mind-boggling at first, if you think you have to do everything at once. Seem like really a very complicated practice. But it's not complicated if you actually do it. If you think about it, you can only think in terms of A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So at that level, it seems endless. But when you actually do the practice, it's here and now, and whatever is predominant in your experience, this is what you investigate. And investigation, you don't mean you have to put your thinking cap onto this. It simply means you just observe it. You know, you just witness. So you're in a position of being a witness rather than a doer, you know, which is our mode. A normal mode is like, I'm going to sit, I'm going to do it, you know, I'm going to really progress on the path, I'm going to, you know, I want some results, I'm going to work for it. And people can meditate for 20 years in that mode and come to you and say, I've got no result in my practice, I'm a mess. You know, it doesn't mean that they have no result, it's just what they expect to have seems very messy. Because we still see the practice as an external thing. We don't realize that the practice has nothing to do with how it looks, with the result we expect. How many of us, you know, are still very much expecting some results in practice? How many disappointments have you been through today with all this expectation? How many times have you been disappointed? There you go. So you see, this is a good point, isn't it? How much energy do we spend in expectation? We're such a bunch of achievers, aren't we? We'd rather not be such a kind of driven nature characters. But there we are, you know, we're still expecting something from the practice. And you do have to come to the point where there is really nothing to get. Now, you don't get to that point by kind of thinking, oh, there's nothing to get. You know how you get there? By simply witnessing the tendency to do that. Simply witnessing, observing, watching, enjoying observing this tendency to want to achieve, to get there, to, you know. We are very much programmed in that mode. It's nothing personal. Don't take it. It's not a great effect of yours or some tragic kind of fate, you know, for having done some terrible karma in past lives, or because your mom didn't sort of take you out in the garden often enough when you were a little boy, little girl. You know, it's a program of. It's the Buddha says it very clearly. It's just a program of delusion, you know. Program of delusion, there's somebody in there doing something, going somewhere. Time exists, space exists. Thought. You can think about the future, you can think about. And that mode of the mind is also very important. You know, how can we pay the bill if we don't think about what we have to do, and how can we plan about the kids' schooling and so on, and the holidays or whatever. We need also to use this mind, you know. But in the practice now, you can rest, put it down, and even though you put it down, it still comes up all the time. Even when you intend, you vow strongly not to get. You don't have to do anything right now. Everything is cared for you, you have lots of delicious food, wonderful retreat managers take care of you. Any problem they'll be spilled, they can solve it, almost more or less. You've got me sort of telling you what to do, spoon feeding you nicely, just at the right time, most of the time. You've got fairly, well, the weather is not so great, but it's not that bad. You don't have to think about anything. You have no reason to complain. And how many of us have complained today? And how many of us have worried about tomorrow? And there's nothing going to happen tomorrow. Nothing much. Another 1 meal a day. Cheese and chocolate in the afternoon. If you're lucky. But how much is already programmed in your mind right now for tomorrow? How much achievements are you expecting from yourself by tomorrow noon? There are two types of desires in the teachings, and I like to mention that because that might help you to understand a little bit better. You know, desire, tanha, is quote-unquote bad. This is a kind of desire. We are here to understand, not to label it bad, but just to understand the suffering it creates in us. Okay? Desire. Desire which comes from fear. Most desires come from fear. You know, we're frightened. So, energy of desire starts churning. You know, if we were not frightened, desire will be much, much less. And then there's another word which for you will be interesting to contemplate. It's called chanda. And chanda means zest. It means interest. It also means desire. It's another translation. Chanda means desire, but it's usually used in relationship with a positive things. You know, it's part of the qualities of the powers of the mind. One of the power of the mind is chanda. Zest, interest, energy. The desire to do something. Not with an end, not with a desire to have result necessarily, but just a simple desire to do something. And to do it well, for its own sake. Without any expectation of results, of any self-gratification, satisfaction, or anything like that. It's a bit like doing a job because you love doing it. not because you get that many pounds at the end of the month. That's chanda. So yeah, there's a kind of joyful interest there, which is ruined when you start doing something just for me, so that I can get gratified, satisfied, and so on. And this is where the joy of our life goes away, because of that tanha, which is rooted deeply into our program of delusion. So, chanda, try to consider that in terms of energy, you know. When you sit in meditation, how much are you just waiting for the big bang to happen? The Satori experience. The end of me. Or even the misguided view that somehow, if you're really doing the correct practice, you should feel happy. Practice leads you to happiness, but happiness is changeable, it's transient. If you let the mind be in its natural state, happiness comes and goes. If you cling to it, then it can appear very permanent. If you absorb or hang on to happiness, it's impermanent, but then until the condition for it go, then it disappears. It's like when you practice metta, you know, some people, you know, don't want to practice metta because it seems like a brainwashing experience and seem like maybe hypocrite. You sort of build up all kind of good feeling and loving the world, loving yourself, and then you open the door, the next thing you want, the next thing you get angry and really irritated with somebody. You know, the outcome of practice is not necessarily happiness or feeling good. In fact, the greatest insights, the greatest breakthrough, the greatest transformation do not take place when you're particularly happy. They take place when you can hold difficult things without moving away from them. This is really you could see the blessing of this path. Is that it's like building this container, the strengthening the container, so that you can stay with those difficult moments, which are just exactly what is needed to move on. And this is a harder thing. The harder thing for us is to stay not just with a little suffering that we feel here and there, but to stay with the suffering of situations which are almost unbearable at times. Now, if you're developing the skill to do this, to actually face situations which are seems insurmountable, unbearable, impossible, and yet, if there is an understanding, if you can read the signs, if you begin to know clearly. And with confidence, you know, that these moments are very precious. They don't come very often. In fact, suffering is a very precious thing. Most people suffer, but they don't even know they are suffering, do they? Ask anybody in the street, you know, looking absolutely terrible, having a dreadful life, miserable. You ask them if they're suffering, they say no. Being aware of suffering is already a very precious thing that you are given. And being able to hold with compassion and wisdom, with understanding, to hold a situation which seems unbearable, it's in those moments that you can truly see the Dhamma. You know, see that you can go through the other side and be enormously strengthened by it. And freer. You feel lighter. And also you feel more confident You know, there's the confidence that arises just out of this capacity to face life fearlessly without wanting something out of life. You see? Having the chanda for life is different than tanha. You know, chanda for life is you really have interest. You want to live this life fully, but not just selfishly. Thinking about the benefit of others, thinking about how you can serve life, how can you be of benefit to this life. So this is in our small ways. You know, this is what we do in our practice. And if you can really come to the point where whatever your mind is asking from you, whatever demands your mind makes on yourself, whatever screaming voices come along and say, I'm not practicing anymore because I can't get this and I can't get that and I can't reach that level of concentration and I can't do this and I'm a total mess. Listen to those voices. That's exactly what you need to practice with. We're so close to them. We think they are interfering with us. This is exactly what the practice takes you to hear all these nagging kind of voices there. That's a result of the good practice. Those nagging voices. And it's not to hold them there. Good practice is not to keep them there and believe in them and start creating another world and another story. Is to be able to listen to them compassionately and allow them to go their way. You know? So this is something I became aware quite a long time ago. But very often I will catch myself again and again seeing them as problems. Here's a problem again. And then suddenly I would wake up and say, no, it's a blessing. My blessing today. Do you understand what I mean? So many times I will just get caught again. Say, oh, they are again. And I just wanted to push them away. I just wanted to get rid of them. And then suddenly I say, no, this is my blessing. Oh, wonderful, they've come along. I can see them. They give me a chance to see them. What a wonderful thing. This happened to me again and again and again. I mean, it's a very amazing experience. Suddenly when you see, wow, problems turn into this kind of blessing. And it's not, you know, I'm not trying to be poetical or inspirational. It's very true. There's suddenly this shift in consciousness. One moment is an obstacle, and the next moment is your doorway, gateway to enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So, we can stop on that.
Samsarayam samagata sadhu gangadama se sadhu 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 sadhu.
So we can end the day with a chant on page 36. It's one of the most famous suttas or teaching of the Buddha, the Metta chant, Karaniya Metta, and this is the English translation. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise will later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living being there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or meeting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So now, as you're going to your resting place, continue to develop this quality of mindfulness as you come out of the shrine room here and onto your bed. As you go to sleep, you can lie down on one side, like the lion's posture on one side. I can't demonstrate it here, but you have one side of the body with the hands underneath your, and one arm on the side of the body there. It's very comfortable. And that's a posture that the Buddha took when he died. So getting yourself ready for the last moment. And as you go to sleep, again, check what your mind is doing. Notice the kind of states of mind, not just the state of mind, but also the states of your body. What the feeling, just go through the body, do a body meditation just before you go to bed. Yeah? Even though your greatest desire might just be just to conk out and not hear another thought. Or another bit of teaching. And you can also, if you want a really good sleep, then you wish yourself well too, and wish other people well. This is a good training. We might not remember to do this all the time, but it's very important, you know, just in terms of seeding the mind with a skillful way of thinking about life. You can wish other people to be well, wish yourself to be well. And the next thing, to intend to get up at a certain time. So in your mind, you say, I will get up at da 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 da. Preferably not 5:25. Because you'll be really stressed by the time you come here. I'll get up at 4:30. Then you have time to do yoga, exercise, cold shower, hot shower. You know, I don't recommend getting up at the last minute, because your mind is a being, you know. And if you just kind of chuck it out of bed and drag it to the meditation hall, it's just like completely wondering what's going on. It's totally, you know, it's functional. It doesn't know what happened. It's like taking a dog, you know, out of sleep and dragging it somewhere, and it's just suddenly just don't quite know how to stand on his four legs. It's the same thing. So be kind to yourself. Getting up a little early, sort of start waking up and giving a chance to realize what's happening, and then come to mindfully to the meditation hall. So you're planting, or you're setting up the conditions for your meditation, the quality of your meditation practice. You know, if you just drag yourself out of sleep, you can go down to your cushion, and the next thing you know, you're just dribbling on your clothes and you're sort of hitting the ground. It happens, you know, these things happen, they're not unheard of. This is a time for you. We are in the course of developing highest level of life qualities, not in terms of the bank account that you may have, but in terms of the Dharma bank account, if you want to use similar terms. Okay. So we do now the closing homage, which probably some of you know by now. Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ avivātemi svākato bhagavata dhammo dhamma namasam supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghanamam. Before we do the next bows, I just want you to think of someone in your life who's been very helpful, a teacher, and this is what we usually do. I just maybe didn't explain it very well at the beginning. So whoever you feel grateful towards, or sense of respect, you know, you can just, this is a bow for this person now.